Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In his third State of the Union address, President Obama focused on fairness and laying the foundation for a stronger future. He's taking this same message on the road this week to kick off his reelection campaign. Republicans claim that President's policies are stifling economic growth. Joining me to talk about last night's speech and the presidential campaign, E.J. Dionne, the Brookings Institution and the Washington Post, James Thurber of American University, and Byron York of the Washington Examiner. I'll look forward to hearing your comments and questions about this speech. Join us throughout the hour by phone, by email, Facebook, or Twitter. And good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to see all of you. E.J. Dionne, what would you say were the highlights of last night's speech?
Well, first of all, if you want clear choices in elections, this election will be an Academy Award election. If you've been wandering around with Republicans, as Byron and I have over the last few weeks, you couldn't have had a clearer contrast of worldview than President Obama gave last night with the Republican worldview. He is running on, we are all in this together. We are a community. We have each other's back. This is not just about individualism or free enterprise, and government can help the economy. That's very different from what the Republicans are saying. But he also backed this up with a whole lot of specifics. I think it was not a Clintonian speech, but the specifics were. And there were a lot of things there that some Republicans have either proposed or many Republicans could embrace. Rick Santorum wants to eliminate taxes on manufacturing. Obama wants to cut them. Obama's proposals on community colleges are the sorts that Republican governors all over the country have supported. So it was this very interesting combination of a big philosophical argument and smaller initiatives that, in principle, Republicans ought to be able to support, although I don't expect it.
Byron.
Well, I think E.J.'s right, except I would say it in the sense that Obama was establishing the themes that we're going to see throughout the 2012 election. And he was setting up the idea of fighting inequality and achieving fairness and everyone sort of paying their fair share and sort of getting their fair share out of government as his main theme. The backdrop to all this, although he never said the words Mitt Romney or used the word 13.9%, which was Mitt Romney's effective tax rate, his bringing in of Warren Buffett's secretary, whom he's often mentioned in speeches, we actually saw her in person in the First Lady's box, his bringing in of her, she was the physical embodiment of his argument that millionaires and billionaires should not pay a lower tax rate than people who get their money in ordinary wages. So I think he set up a lot of the fight for the 2012 election.
Jim Thurber.
Well, I agree with both of them, but let me add to it that this was really a populist speech. It was a poke at the dysfunctional Congress. Americans have had it with Congress. It was at 8% in December. Now it's back up to 13%. They think it's dysfunctional. And he warned them that if they don't go along with some of these things, he's going to act on his own.
How can he do that?
Well, through regulatory action at EPA, through other actions in other agencies. I think that this was a campaign speech as well as a governing speech. He doesn't do a very good job about bragging about what he has done. He did a little bit of it in this speech about health care, about regulation of financial institutions.
You think he should have bragged more?
I think he should. It should have been shorter, and he should have bragged more, and then he should have talked about the future in terms of fair taxes, jobs and education and energy. Those were in there, but it got mixed up with a lot of small bore ideas.
Byron.
Well, it is the small bore ideas that you can accomplish through executive power. You need Congress to do bigger things. And the fact is, the president has accomplished what he's going to accomplish in his first term. And the signature accomplishment, of course, is national health care. And I think I read that he devoted about 40-something words to national health care. And his message was, there's no way we're going back. But other than that, he really didn't discuss it. He did brag on his accomplishments. He started out with Osama bin Laden. Just in case anybody forgot, I got Osama bin Laden. But in terms of his legislative accomplishments, he did not brag a lot about health care because it's not really popular right now.
Yeah, you know, Jim made the point that it should have been shorter, and maybe he's right, although whenever I hear that, I am reminded of those old Clinton speeches where he was constantly criticized for packing program after program after program, and it turned out that lots of people out there heard a particular thing that they said, yeah, that's what we should be doing. They heard a program that helped them or a program that made sense, so that I guess I have become over the years more sympathetic to the old laundry list. And I think the laundry list in this case was evidence, because if he's going to argue against what seemed to be the message of the 2010 elections, the government actually can do good things. He needs to make a pretty powerful case. And so each of those programs was a building block for that case.
Of course, he opened and closed with the success of getting Osama bin Laden, and then with the special forces success on Monday night.
And, you know, the theme there was about community, coming together, working as a team. It was quite moving for me, the way he ended the speech, the way he started the speech. Our military is quite good, and it's a team. You have to come together, and he used that analogy for politics. You've got to come together to solve these problems. But the overall speech was a contrast between the Republicans and the Democrats, in the sense that he was arguing for government to solve problems, not exactly bigger government, but government needs to solve problems, and the Republicans are saying, well, just let the private sector do that. And it hasn't worked in the financial area and the housing area to do that.
And especially on the financial area, he focused on the theme of economic fairness on the tax code. Especially, he again talked about a new minimum tax for people making over $1 million. How far is he going to get with that, Byron?
You know, this is something I thought, I was kind of amazed when, with the fight focused on taxpayers of $250,000 and more for so much of his administration. And there were Democrats, I think Charles Schumer among them, saying, let's talk about people who make $1 million or more, because everybody can, you know, almost everybody makes less than $1 million, and they can kind of identify with this. And there are a lot of two-earner families, especially in expensive areas, that are pushing at $250,000 range. The $1 million is an effective argument for the Democrats. And also, what we've seen with Romney this week is the living embodiment of the capital gains tax. And I think most people agree that capital gains should be taxed at a lower rate than ordinary income. That's the way it's worked for a very long time, and people of all political persuasions benefit from it. But with Romney, you see a man who made $21 million and paid an effective tax rate of 13.9%. And so there you see an actual physical example of it, and the president will no doubt be pushing that very hard as the campaign goes on.
Byron's exactly right about the Romney issue, and boy, did Mitt Romney do him a big favor by releasing his tax return. Expected Romney to be sitting with Mrs. Obama just so Obama could call him out as an example.
Timing is everything.
What you're going to say, Byron?
No, I asked the campaign. I sent the note to the Romney people saying, just curious, you could have released this stuff on Thursday. You know, why did you do it on the morning of the State of the Union address when you knew what President Obama was going to do? I did not get a response.
One small point. There was a moment when the capital gains tax was the same as taxes on ordinary income. It was signed into law by Ronald Reagan as part of the tax reform of 1986. And, you know, and I think that's sort of, well, that's what Obama is pushing back to. I thought that what was really interesting is a lot of people talk in vague terms about tax reform. What he was talking is very specifically about tax reform that is primarily aimed at making sure the very wealthy pay their fair share, rather than tax reform in the abstract. So he would end up, I think, when you see the proposal, take away some of the housing benefits and some of the health care benefits from those taxpayers, but only people earning over $1 million a year.
And what about manufacturing jobs and his talk about taxing those companies who take their jobs overseas, providing tax benefits for those who establish here? Jim Thurber.
Well, it's something that's, I think, is going to be very popular with the American public, and it's an incentive to bring jobs home. Very complex. When you get into that type of tax code, you have to have a very large tax reform going on. I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately, during this year. Why? The House of Representatives is further to the right. There's no moderates. Moderates is a dirty word in the House of Representatives for Republicans. There's only about 5% of the people in the House that could be considered moderate. The blue dogs are gone. Moderate Democrats, they can't help. The Senate doesn't have 60 votes. I think we're going to have deadlock. As we go into these big issues of tax reform, he will continue to hit it, and it will be very popular, in my opinion, especially the tax on millionaires, because people can understand it. When you start talking about bringing jobs home, giving people tax breaks for that, it gets a little complex for the election.
Two things. One, about bringing jobs home, it's not just the Republican House. The president also invited to the First Lady's box the widow of Steve Jobs. And how one can rail against outsourcing and celebrate Apple at the same time is beyond me. We had a terrific article in the New York Times this week about how Apple uses hundreds of thousands of workers in China to make their products. But the bigger issue on the tax issue is unemployment rate is still 8.5%. I think the president, and it may go up as more workers re-enter the workforce. A lot of this is an effort to redirect the conversation away from the big glaring problem in front of the president.
Byron York, The Washington Examiner. Short break and right back. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850, send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. EJ, you want to add something on manufacturing?
Right. I thought this was a very interesting initiative. First of all, it's about time we start thinking about restoring manufacturing jobs. But secondly, Democrats for a long time have said, let's take the tax benefit away from companies that offshore jobs. What Obama did is an interesting twist. He said, let's take that benefit away, but then let's give new benefits to manufacturing. They have a special benefit for advanced manufacturing, kind of high-tech manufacturing.
Do you think that could make a difference?
I think, I don't know about passing anything this year,
yeah.
But I think what he's talking about here is corporate tax reform, and to have us look at the corporate tax code and say, what incentives do we actually want, as opposed to a random collection of preferences stuck in there by various lobby groups? And you can actually make a case for, I mean, we could argue about it. Free market purists would say these things don't work, but I think you can make a case for why this kind of incentive could actually help the country.
But watching Baucus during that statement,
I saw that.
Right. He didn't, he sat there, he didn't clap. He looked like a Republican in terms of the response to this.
Interesting.
And he's chairman of the Finance Committee that has jurisdiction over all of this.
I thought that was interesting. Here's an email from Linda in Laurel Fork, Virginia. I heard one of your panelists say, quote, everyone agrees that capital gains should be taxed at a lower rate than wages. Why do we agree that people who work for their money should be taxed more than people whose money works for them? As a retired person, that works for me. But as a fair person, I'm not so sure.
Well, the basic, that was me. I said that.
Yes, I disagreed. Just
And I disagreed also.
Argument for a lower capital gains tax is that money goes into investments that stimulate the economy and create jobs. So you tax it at a lower rate. Now, you can agree with it or disagree with it, but it has been that way for quite a long time.
And the question will be whether that area of the tax code gets attention this year.
Right.
Well, President Obama is focusing mostly on raising the income tax of people who make more than $1 million a year. That's what he's doing.
And the argument that Buffett makes $1 billion and his secretary pays a much higher rate is a very poignant argument, in my opinion.
Just as a matter of history, it hasn't been this low for very long, that cutting it all the way down to 15% was done in the Bush tax bill. We've had much higher capital gains levels in the past. It was, you know, it's been cut over a series of years since the 70s. So there's nothing written on tablets about a low capital gains rate.
And so this comes up again at the end of this session, maybe after the election, when the Bush tax cuts expire, unless there's a positive action by the Hill. We'll go back to the old rate.
I see.
And with a deadlocked House and Senate, he has a lot of power, because if they do nothing, then we go back to the other rate.
Byron, let's talk about Mitch Daniels' response. How effective do you believe that was?
You know, it's always a tough situation to follow the president. You're sitting in a room by yourself, and the president's been in this sort of glorious joint session of Congress. I thought he did as well as you could do. It was interesting. He started out with kind words for President Obama. There's a consensus. I shouldn't say consensus again. A lot of Republican strategists agree, you shouldn't attack President Obama personally. Say he's a nice guy. He's done some good things. He has a very nice family. So you say a few good things, and
so
then you
say,
strategy. Oh, absolutely. And then you say, but he's failed. We entered office. He didn't create the financial crisis. He entered office. His job was to fix it, and he has failed doing it. And it is time for new leadership. So I think that Daniels made that argument as well as anybody has.
And the analogy of going across the Niagara with debt and deficit, it was very important, but he didn't have very many specifics about how to solve that. He just wanted, he wanted government to shrink a little bit and allow the private sector to produce more revenues, and that's not working. And so I think he was a bit too general about what should be done as an alternative to the president's solutions.
I was so struck by that praise of President Obama's family and his giving a great example to the country. One couldn't avoid mischievously thinking, is he saying something about Newt Gingrich and all the controversy around Newt? I thought two things about Daniels. On the one hand, in terms of presentation, he's not a dynamic speaker. And yet the content of that speech I found quite interesting, because it had some criticisms of the Republican Party in it, which it was actually a pretty partisan speech, but he took some of that edge off. And I think he sounded just a little bit less mean than what you're hearing out there on the campaign trail. And I think that would actually be helpful to the Republicans. I think it was a more effective argument for having some of the sort of hyperbolic attacks.
But he showed the cleavages in the party. They have serious problems.
Which
in the Republican
is
party.
Why a lot of people are still wondering if Mitch Daniels is going to step in at the convention.
Well, he had his chance, and he decided not to take it.
There was so far.
So far and probably permanently. First of all, he didn't run for family reasons, as a matter of fact. He said his wife and daughters did not want him to run for president, and he was going to observe their wishes. I do think that there is a recurring fantasy among some Republican strategists of some candidate who will just come in and save the party from disaster. Somebody's going to win the Florida primary on January 31st. It'll probably be either Romney or Gingrich, meaning they will have won two of the first four contests. And the idea that a group of Republican wise men will step in and tell the voters of Florida to, you know, take a hike, we'll take over now, is, I think, just not realistic.
Which wise men? I just want to say, I think that on Florida, if Romney wins Florida, I think he may restore his path to the nomination. If Gingrich wins Florida, you sure have a sense among Republicans in Washington, if not necessarily wise men and women, that they really don't want Newt to be the nominee. And I think a Gingrich victory could set off this scenario, even though I agree with Byron, it's very hard to see mechanically how it would work.
Well, you tell the voters to go take a hike. I mean, you made your decision, but we don't like it.
Or you have somebody try to enter late primaries. Again, I agree with you. This is probably fantasy, but I think a Gingrich victory in Florida could set off all kinds of explosions.
But remember, it's proportional representation. If Mitt loses in Florida and is very close, it goes out to March. I lean towards the idea that Mitt wins because he's got a lot of money, he's got a lot of discipline. He may be a little dull, people think, but he can continue to pursue it right through March. And Newt is a big question mark with no money.
All right. Before we get into the intricacies of the campaign, let's get back to the speech on energy. What did you think of what President Obama had to say?
But well, I'm going to adopt the Republican talking point, which is the two things. One, it was interesting to hear the president say he favors an all-of-the-above strategy, which was John McCain's campaign line from 2008. And the second thing, what was interesting to hear the president not say anything about the Keystone Pipeline, which was a major energy and jobs issue that the president has nixed, at least for now, widely assumed to be to satisfy his environmental supporters who are opposed to it. But it from a Republican point of view, and I think this is a valid criticism, there's a big project right there that will help increase production. And since it's oil from Canada coming to the United States, it's a stable, safe, non-crazy supply of oil. And the president said no.
But you've got the state of Nebraska still objecting to that.
And the Keystone thing is not as much about the pipeline as it is using lots of water and producing a lot of carbon to get oil shale out of Calgary. And that's what environmentalists are primarily worried about. He sounded like a Republican on energy. Drill, baby, drill. We've got lots of
public lands.
Yeah, on public lands, and we've got lots of natural gas. But he also pointed out that fracking research was funded by the federal government and showing that the government was involved. He also danced around bad loans to solar energy companies and said we still have to pursue that and that we're going to have some bad bets, but we still have to go ahead with alternative energy.
I agree with Jim, most of what Jim said. I think what was also interesting is the Republicans' favorite word, or one of their favorite words, is Solyndra, not a word that appeared in this speech.
I should have pointed out that wasn't in there.
Noticed I didn't say Solyndra.
Right. But what was really interesting is Obama said he was really saying, I'm doubling down on this. Yes. In effect, these words weren't in the speech, but what he was saying in effect is we should keep investing in clean energy, and there are going to be some failures, but it's worth doing because there are going to be successes in the long run. So he's actually not giving any ground on that issue, even though he wisely didn't mention that magic word.
And on public land, he's talking about solar and wind primarily. not drilling as much as solar and wind, and we've got big solar farms on public land out west.
And this is going to continue to be a big campaign issue. He didn't mention Solyndra because it did involve $500 million in lost federal money on a project that just didn't work. And there are other Solyndras
that began
out
in the Bush administration.
The Bush administration had not moved forward on it. The Obama administration put the pedal to the metal.
Let me ask you what he's proposing about insider trading among members of Congress.
Well, that was very popular, and he wants to support a bill that's going forward, it looks like, to prevent members of Congress to trade on inside information that would affect particular stocks. And I think that America, supports that. Certainly the members all stood up and applauded. And there are very few members that took advantage of that, but there were members that did so.
About his proposal to merge some departments of the government? For example, commerce.
Right. Well, it's going to be interesting. I think the Republicans may actually work with him on this, even though they're reluctant to give this president, that executive authority. And I, for one, wish he had started on government reform a long time ago, because I think if you are a progressive of any kind, first question you got to answer is, well, you guys want to use a lot of government. Can you make government work? And so I think it's both a good thing to do on the merits in terms of reforming government, but secondly, I think it's an essential thing to do politically.
So what happens to the office of the special trade representative, for example? That gets folded into commerce?
It could happen. My sense is that not much is going to happen this year. It's just not going to happen because the two sides are not really interested in working together. And you can say, well, you could come together on a few things, and you could present to the American people that we can work together on this. Generally, the 8 months before a presidential election are not a major productive period for legislation.
Jim.
Yes. Reorganization of committees on the Hill, but also departments it's very, very difficult. There's all kinds of specialized interests that want the status quo. The status quo generally wins on everything in Washington, especially on this. Last State of the Union message, he promised to do something. He got a report. He didn't like it, but he still went ahead with the reorganization. I think it's going to be very difficult to get done.
James Thurber of American University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. I want to hear what our listeners have to say. Good morning, Bea in Dallas, Texas. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, guests. I've just got a comment. After listening to President Obama's speech last night, I'm wondering if the American people are thinking about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, when President Obama took office, this country was at its knees. And some of the same people that are now talking and saying, making all kinds of comments and saying things, are some of the same people that helped to put it there. What is your guess? What is their comment about that? And I'd like to say comment that the Republican Party reminds me of the Tower, of the story in the Old Testament of the Tower of Babel. They just all speaking a different language, and they don't even know what they're doing.
All right, thanks for calling, B. Go ahead, Byron.
Well, the Republican argument is that it's pretty straightforward, which is the president did not inherit the financial crisis. He had an unprecedented opportunity to deal with it. He chose to spend a year instituting a national health care program. Jobs are still the main issue of the American people. Unemployment is high, could go higher even if the economy begins to recover. It could go higher as more people reenter the workforce. And the deficit, which was down to about $160 billion in 2007, is completely out of control in a way that Obama administration officials themselves say is unsustainable. So I think they have a pretty good argument that it's a change is necessary.
First of all, thanks to Bea for her scriptural reference. I like that. I think Obama was very explicit in trying to make exactly the argument she put forward. He said, in the 6 months before I took office, we lost nearly 4 million jobs, and we lost another 4 million before our policies were in full effect. And he's really trying to draw a line here. Ronald Reagan did the same thing. Unemployment hit 10.2%. Now, in fairness to Byron's side of the argument, the growth began more quickly under Reagan than it has under Obama. Nonetheless, he's trying to say, look, I inherited a mess. The policies that were in place before I took office were, to use his words, wrong and irresponsible. And he can take that up to a point. I mean, I think that the Republicans are going to say it should have been fixed faster. And that's really the core of their argument. But I think that a lot of Americans are open to the idea that, yes, he did inherit a mess. And he made that case last night.
But the core of his argument
is he moved immediately on the stimulus package. One third tax cuts that the Republicans wanted, one third unemployment compensation and Medicaid, and one third, quote, shovel-ready jobs, but most of those went to teachers and cops and people in state government that Republicans wanted. He prevented, he would argue, a deeper recession, maybe even a depression. We had 7.8% unemployment when he got into office. The problem is we've got 8.5% unemployment now. It's hard to prove a negative that what he did prevented something worse. But remember, he used TARP money to bail out the automobile industry. It got going, created lots of jobs. He helped save the banks. He helped save a further decline in our housing market. So it's hard to make those arguments that it would have been worse if he hadn't done that. Cool. I don't think he spent all of his time on health care. He didn't spend enough time bragging about what he did with stimulus and TARP, in my opinion.
And Byron, you'll have a chance to comment when we come back after a short break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And by the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Language and the Brain: How the process of mastering new and complex skills differs as we age, and what it takes to become a lifelong learner. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Just before the break, Byron, you were waiting for your turn to respond.
I was bursting with impatience. during the break, actually, we were talking about how much time the president devoted to cap and trade, which did not pass in the Senate in the first year of his presidency, which further reinforced the notion, which I believe is actually true, that he spent far more time on an agenda that included health care and the environment at a time when the American people were absolutely crazed about unemployment. Unemployment was obviously very high, hit 10%. People who had jobs were scared of losing them. This was the biggest single issue. And if you look at how the Republicans won in 2010 in November, they've done a lot of polling about how it was they won. Did they win because they were talking about reducing the size of government, or did they win because they were saying, where are the jobs, Mr. President? Overwhelmingly, people voted because of the jobs issue.
I agree that in retrospect, they spent a lot of time on cap and trade and got nothing for it, and that the defeat of that bill in the Senate may have been predictable. The question is, could he have gotten more stimulus through? Could he have gotten another jobs program through at that point? And maybe if he had fought hard for it, the House did pass a little bit more, which also couldn't make it through the Senate. Some of the problem is the Senate, as we keep saying. But I think it would have been useful either to have a bigger stimulus or a second one.
I think he overlearned the Clinton mistake in 1994 with health care reform. They didn't bring in the chairs enough and coordinate what they wanted. They ignored them, and it was sort of arrogant. And so he leaned too far to the chairs, and they had too much power. And Henry Waxman, chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, had jurisdiction over health care and cap and trade, and he really moved hard to the left. There was no way those bills would pass the Senate.
All right, let's go to Hagerstown, Maryland. Good morning, Brooke.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. President Obama focused a lot on manufacturing in his speech last night, but he's still pursuing flawed trade policies that actually don't support the American worker. He just passed the leftover Bush-era Korea Free Trade Agreement that was set to cost Americans 159,000 manufacturing jobs. And now he's pursuing the Trans-Pacific Partnership that contains the same foreign investor protections as NAFTA. And we've already lost over 5 million of our manufacturing jobs. And if President Obama truly wants to support American workers, he needs to support trade policies that support them, too.
EJ.
The lady is pointing to a real divide in the Democratic coalition among progressives that has existed since at least the Clinton years. And the president is trying to paper that over by saying there are other things you can do to bring manufacturing home. The one good piece of news, I think, for the president is, to some degree on this manufacturing question, the winds are with them a little bit. There are signs, and some business folks are talking about this, that there is a return of American manufacturing. The costs are going up in China. So I think it is not unrealistic to think that manufacturing jobs will return. But the lady's absolutely right. There is this fundamental divide on the impact of these trade agreements.
But in order to get the free trade agreement passed, which was South Korea, Panama and Colombia, there were investments in retraining of workers. It was very hard to get that through. The Republicans supported it. And the analysis is that more jobs will be created than lost as a result of this from the administration. People challenge those numbers, but that was the argument. Secondly, he wanted, and he said that he wanted a fairer situation with China. He wanted to go after stealing of intellectual property. And that's an appeal also to Republicans as well as Democrats.
Here's an email saying, I was disappointed I didn't hear more on the housing crisis in the State of the Union address. My mom suffered a financial hardship in 2008. Her mortgage is 75% of her income. If I did not move back home, we would have entered foreclosure a long time ago. Byron.
He didn't talk a lot about it, and he did speak about trying to help homeowners who are underwater with their mortgages, but he's done what he can do on that. And what Mitt Romney said a while back, which is that part of this situation is letting the situation work itself out, because the sad fact is that if people are in homes that they just clearly cannot afford, they need to leave the homes.
He also said he put in a piece on refinancing for people who can't afford to pay for the house. So it was a little bit of tough love. There are a lot of people that shouldn't have had these houses. They're underwater, and he didn't say that he was going to save them.
That could get a lot of money in the hands of people. If the Republicans If I were a Republican, I would criticize him for not doing enough on housing. The problem for Republicans is that ideologically, as Byron said, they really don't want to do anything. They want the market to settle. So that critique is closed to them.
Okay.
Well, you give a certain amount of help to people who are in close situations, who with a certain amount of help could stay. But there are clearly people who are just not going to be able to stay in the houses. And for that to work itself out.
Okay, I want to clarify something. Angie in Baltimore says, I took offense to Diane's comment regarding taxing investment income versus people who, quote, work for their money. My husband and I both work full-time, live modestly in order to invest in the market for our retirement or future emergencies. We are taxed on our hard-earned income before our money goes into a Roth IRA. Just wanted you to know, Angie, that wasn't my comment. It came from another emailer, Linda in Laurel Fork, Virginia. Let's go now.
Diane, could I speak to that for a second?
Sure.
It deals with the upcoming campaign also, because there are a lot of retirees that live off their investments. Now, if you look at the 2010 election, there was a significant shift of people 65 years and older that had voted for Obama and shifted and voted for Republicans. He has to appeal to that group in terms of protection of Medicare, sometimes Medicaid, but Social Security, but also in terms of people earning money in retirement off their investments. That's a tricky one.
And that's why drawing the line at $1 million actually protects a lot of those people, so that politically, as Byron pointed out at the beginning of the show, it's a lot easier when you do it that way than when you go further down the income ladder.
All right. To Lydia in Woodstock, Illinois. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I hated the speech. I campaigned. I campaigned for candidate Obama. I do understand that he has talent, but that's a lazy speech. I'm going to speak through my friend Ron Herring, a professor who was shot because he would have scolded Mr. Obama. And Ron Herring's not here to do that. But where everybody gets a fair shot is one of the headlines in New York Times today. That's a very, very poorly put together speech on the eve of Gabby Giffords' resignation. That is really lazy. I will not is also lazy. How many times did you hear that in that speech? I don't have a background in this, but if I have to work really hard listening to that speech, and I certainly did, he hasn't done his work, and his speechmaker should be fired, and he needs to do harder work as well.
Jim Thurber.
Well, I'm a professor. I don't scold presidents. I try to analyze what they're doing. And indeed, I disagree with the questioner here. I think that it was a good speech, but it was too long. It was too much like a professor. I loved it as a professor, but I think he needed to keep it short. He needed to have a clear strategy, theme, and message around fair taxes, jobs, energy, and cooperation. He could have done that in half the time. I don't think it was lazy. I think, and in fact, he wrote a lot of it, and we know that. I think that he just tried to include too much in it.
I do think in terms, for general listeners like me, there's a certain Groundhog Day quality to State of the Union addresses. They tend to blend together. And as a matter of fact, the Republican National Committee released a video. They've done a lot of research less than an hour later, putting clips together of Obama's 2010 or 2011 speeches next to him saying virtually the same thing last night about our crumbling roads and bridges, about our schools and all sorts of different things. So there is a been there, done that quality to some of these speeches.
Lydia also wanted to say that it would be better for the president to say, I will support, I will encourage, rather than I will not.
You know, there is, I think people underestimate the power of negative thinking in politics. How did Ronald Reagan rise? He was against communism. He was against big government. He was against taxes. And you can build a positive program out of what you're against. And I agree in general that you ought to propose something after you say what you're against. But I think right now, given the political divisions in the country, you got to say both what you're against as well as what you're for.
But also what you did. Because he made certain promises, and he referred to those promises and his performance. Now, the advertisement just before the State of the Union message on two channels, on CNN and one other channel, had an ad of about 10 of his promises and how he didn't meet those promises. Very effective, in my opinion.
All right. To New Haven, Connecticut. Hi there, Roger.
Yes, good morning. I love your show.
Thanks.
I want to comment on the rationale for a lower capital gain. The only thing I think was mentioned by the panel was to encourage investment. On that one, I would put a but. When you invest money in a regular savings account, that ultimately goes to investment by the banks, mortgages, and so on. However, savings interest is taxed as regular income, and you know there's a disconnect there. The other thing is the capital gain normally has a potential loss side. You have your capital, you put it in, you could potentially lose something. So maybe there's an intended compensation, say it went from $100 to $150, maybe the expected gain is seen to be $125, and you just happen to win that bet. Maybe they're trying to adjust for that. Incidentally, that particular issue is an argument against why hedge fund managers should be allowed to use capital gain, because they have no downside. They don't have any fat in the fire. And if they're managing other people's money, they shouldn't be allowed to take that at the capital gains rate, which, of course, was an issue recently. And the third thing is the gains, especially if they're held for a while, have also the adjustment to be made for inflation. If you put $100 in, you get $150 out, say, 5 years later. If you can only buy a $125 market basket of goods that you could have bought when you originally put that money in, maybe that's an adjustment that the capital gains rate is attempting to take care of. And again, I don't know what the legislators were thinking, but those are other issues, at least, to contemplate.
Could I just ask one question? You've thought about this a lot. Do you think that capital gains should be taxed at the same rate as ordinary income?
I generally am in favor of the idea of equity, and also not having people like Warren Buffett necessarily walking away, especially since it bothers him. But maybe there is some justification. And as far as my thinking about this, I would guess it was maybe 10 minutes after the issue came up on the show. But it strikes me that there are some issues, and I don't know how it should be resolved.
But 15% is much too low, in
your
opinion?
I would guess that. Right. Yes, I would think so.
If he did it in 10 minutes, he would have been very good in a classroom when he was a student.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Traverse City, Michigan. Hi there, Kevin. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Diane. Thanks for having me on. And good morning to your guest. Just a quick comment in relationship to something that Governor Daniels said in his response that I thought was the height of condescension, and I haven't heard the analysis of. His line was that America is a country that is and always has been made up of haves and soon to have. And as the Great Recession continues to destroy the middle class, I don't think I've heard any rhetoric from the right that was more insulting to somebody who's struggling to put food on the table for his family.
Byron.
Well, this is if you listen to Republicans very much, you hear them talk. They don't talk about income inequality. They talk about income mobility. And they talk about the United States. When you look at X number of people, how many of them are in a better place today than they were when they were born? And the number is extraordinary. So even Rick Santorum, who alone among Republicans talks about reviving manufacturing jobs and the struggle that people without college degrees have in the economy, even Santorum consistently phrases it in terms of income mobility. So what Daniel said was perfectly consistent with that.
I just want to tell the caller he lives in a very beautiful place, and he makes a good point. I found that formulation odd. The core problem with the conservative argument is we have less upward mobility now than many of those social democracies in Europe that they call an entitlement society. And it's not a crisis of equality alone. It's really a crisis of upward mobility in our country.
But the president is talking about income opportunity. investment in education, giving people a fair shake in terms of retraining them for jobs. It really is very close to the question of income mobility. Give them the opportunity and give them a fair shot, a fair share, and not give them an entitlement program, give them a way to compete. And that's part. That was a big part of the speech.
But healthcare was about redistribution, wasn't it?
Well, healthcare was about cost, quality, access, and
finance.
He
didn't even mention the Affordable Care Act last time.
Yeah, it's about cost, quality, access, and finance. It's about reducing the cost of healthcare by putting people in big pools, saving $330 billion. It is not socialized medicine. It's not redistribution.
Oh, it really was. I mean, as a matter of fact, after it was passed, people like the New York Times columnist David Leonhardt and others came out and said, you know, this is the most important redistributive act passed in a very long time. It's about extending coverage to previously uncovered people and subsidizing their ability to pay for it.
And if giving every American access to health care is redistribution, what in the world is wrong with that? I just don't think we should get hung up on the word redistribution. It's a good thing to provide everyone with health care. In my view, we can disagree on that.
It was about access. It was about putting cost controls on docs and hospitals, maybe redistribution in that way.
And on that note, we shall end. James Thurber, E.J. Dionne, Byron York. Thank you all so much.
Thank you,
Thank
Diane.
You, Diane.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot